This week on the Young Money Podcast, we have Tyler. He talks about how his mom used to reuse tape to save money, the ins and outs of going through teacher's college and working at charities, and he tells us about his Pop-Tart addiction. That and much more coming up next on the Young Money Podcast. Welcome to the Young Money Podcast. I'm JP.
And I'm Adrian.
And this week we have a special guest, Tyler. Welcome on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. So do you want to just start off with telling us a little bit about how you grew up with money and how your parents viewed money? And yeah, a little bit of your background.
Yeah, for sure. I'd be happy to. So my parents have always been very stingy. I joke with them that, or frugal, I guess, is the nicer way to put that. But I do think there's a difference between being stingy and frugal. It's a difference between penny pinching and wanting to save. And I think my parents were more or less right on that line. I joke with them sometimes that that they'll say they'll reuse tape. They're definitely stingier than me. But I grew up in that environment. I think I sort of have a natural tendency also to want to save. So I grew up being very stingy, and now I'm working my way back into a more reasonably frugal lifestyle. So I like saving money, but I understand that money has a use, I think, and that there are a lot more important things than money, like family, relationships, and especially your personal health. So those are the things that I try to put before money. And yeah, so I guess we'll get a little more into sort of what exactly that means with some of the like later in the podcast, but yeah, that's sort of an overview of how I grew up with money. Very stingy and learning to be less stingy and more frugal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did your parents ever like espouse lessons to you, or did you just see them reuse tape and then you kind of gathered that they were more stingy?
It's both. So when I was younger, my dad really want, and by younger, I mean until recently. So, from like age zero to maybe 22 or 23, I didn't really want to think about money very much. I knew I had enough of it. Like our family is reasonably well off, in no small part due to my parents' frugality. Like neither of my parents are extremely, or were, they're both retired now, extremely highly paid. My mom was a stay-at-home mom for my whole life. And my dad, traveled around to restaurants repairing, beer lines for, brewers retail. So again, we didn't have a massive amount of income. But I grew up in a reasonably sized house in a nice neighborhood, and I didn't have absolutely everything I wanted. We weren't rich by any means, but I had everything I needed and most of the things that I wanted. So again, like to answer your question, my dad always tried to espouse lessons on me about how to invest and what to do with my tax returns and how to do my tax returns. And I just did not care at all until I was like 23, I think. And in the last couple of years, I've sort of made the transition to living in a different city from them, working my first full-time quote unquote adult jobs. And with that came a lot more interest in what my dad had to say. And we've had a lot of really good conversations, about where to put your money when investing, and how to take investing advice, especially from investment bankers and investment professionals, with a grain of salt. So yeah, I saw the reused tape so my mom would actually use tape to label like reusable containers of cereal and stuff like that, and she would literally reuse that tape. So we had a drawer, and on the inside of the drawer, there were all the tapes of like all the possible cereals we've ever had. So if we get them again, we can just reuse that tape and we don't have to spend another,
God, that's amazing,
0.001 of a cent on a piece of tape and a little bit of ink from a marker. So yeah, I saw some of that, but I also got some lessons, which I'm recently learning how to hear.
Yeah, so like it sounds like you and your dad have had some like really constructive conversations about finance. I'm just wondering if there's like a specific moment or time in which you realize the importance of money. Like, was it like one single thing that you realize like, oh wow, money is like how the world runs? Or was it just like a gradual understanding over time?
I think it's a gradual understanding over time that can be encapsulated in realizing that that money's not all important. Because as I said, I sort of made the journey from penny pinching to reasonably frugal. And so in my sort of early adult years, maybe from age 20 to 23 or something like that, I learned that money is a tool and it's not necessarily the goal. And especially since moving to Toronto, there's a lot of keeping up with the Joneses. There's a lot of, you know, the house I'm living in right now that I'm thankfully renting, you know, it's a house that would probably go for $200,000 or $300,000 in Kingston. And it's a $1.5 million house here. And it's normal for people to buy those and view them as investments as well as view it as the normal thing to do. Whereas in reality, a lot of people are stretching themselves financially to do that. And, you know, for example, in the midst of a pandemic, if you lose your job, or if both you and your spouse lose your job, or there is some health condition that prevents you from doing your job, or you take a pay cut at your job, even often that really affects whether you can afford your mortgage. A lot of people are living right up to their means. And it's not, I think living in Toronto has helped me realize that it's not, you know, as cliche as it sounds, not to judge your own progress based on the appearance of other people's progress.
Yeah. Do you find that living in Toronto, because this is something that I get sometimes whenever I'm talking to people in Toronto or whatever, I'm like in a social situation with people in Toronto, that money and expenses are never really overtly discussed. Like everybody's going out to dinner all the time. Everybody has these really expensive rents. And it's like, in my mind, I'm doing the math and I'm like, how does this make sense? Like, how are you affording this? Do you get this, that sense too? Or do you kind of keep a group of friends that openly talk about this kind of stuff?
No, that's a really good question. I try to keep a group of friends who are open about it, but it's still definitely, I think it's not necessarily a Toronto thing, but I think it is stronger here. That it's just built up in our society that you don't talk about money. And I think there's some reason in that. There's some sense in that sentiment because it can be a tool for people to make other people jealous. That whole societal norm is not what I'm about. And I definitely find myself trying to calculate the expenses of other people. I just moved into this house with a couple of friends, and one of them has a car. He just took a pay cut at work, and he has student loans. And so over the course of the last couple of weeks that I've been living with him, I've been sort of, you know, just as they come up in conversation, keeping sort of a running tally of what his expenses and income seem to be. And, you know, I'll even ask people, like, how much do you make? Or how much are your student loans, which I think people might not necessarily like, but I think that's sort of my way of trying to break that societal norm, because I'm really happy to share that information for myself. But I understand that I think part of that willingness to share for me comes from a strong financial background, feeling financially secure, and feeling like I'm sort of quote unquote doing things right, or doing several things right at least. As well as on top of all that, a willingness to learn from other people. So if other people are, you know, making mistakes by getting into lots of credit card debt, I want to learn how that happened to them, or maybe how I can avoid it, or maybe if there's some advice I can impart on them to help them. I think having these conversations is really valuable. And I have a really, you know, I'm interested in personal finance, obviously, or I probably wouldn't be on this podcast. And so I find myself sort of mentally trying to figure out what the expenses of other people are, what the income and expenses are. And a lot of the time in Toronto, as you said, it really seems like people feel that they can't save money, but it seems like more of a choice not to. I mean, it's kind of a choice, because if the only time you get to spend with your friends is going out to bars or whatever, and that's what your friend group does, then I understand that there's some pressure to spend money that way. But I still sort of view it as a choice, because you can pressure your friend group to go play tennis or do something free instead, right?
yeah. That's always a tough thing, right? Because it might be because we've all grown up relatively lucky that we can feel comfortable talking about that. But I feel as though those who have not grown up in a lucky financial environment are the ones who need those kinds of uncomfortable conversations the most. So it's a hard balance, because you either get a dirty look, or you know, maybe hopefully help people out.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good point.
You touched a little bit on your, like, you know, your financial background and how you're financially stable. I was wondering, like, what your first, like, job was, and you know, if you remember how much you got paid then.
Yeah, you're testing my memory here. Oh, I think it was in grade eight. So I was grade eight or grade nine, maybe a little later. Yeah, grade eight or grade nine. So I was 13 or 14, I think, if my math is right.
Can you legally work at that age?
I think it was sort of a family friend owned a local store. And I was able to work my first summer stocking grocery shelves. And I wasn't very good at it. I didn't enjoy it very much. And I was offered to continue working once a week into the school year. And then by the time October rolled around, my employer was like, eh. They didn't say this directly to me, but the way that I've sort of viewed it looking back is that they were like, you don't really want to be here. We don't really need you here that bad. You can just, you know, go be a kid, go do your own thing. It's the school year. It's not busy like it is in the summer. You don't have free time like you do in the summer. So, that was my first, real paycheck. Whether I can't remember if I was legally working or not. I think I was, so maybe it was a little older. But I also babysat a little bit before that. And so, yeah, I'm not sure which one would count as my real job. Was there another part to the question, Agent?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you remembered how much you got paid.
Yeah, so I think maybe nine.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds about right.
Do you remember what you would do with those first few paychecks?
Growing up, my mom would always pack my lunches for me. So even because she was a full-time stay-at-home mom. So even until grade 12, and then in second year of university, I actually lived at home as well, and she insisted on packing my lunches then too. I'm still learning how to cook for myself now because of that. I think it's honestly crippled me a little bit in the kitchen. the first thing that I remember spending my money on from that grocery store job was packs of Pop-Tarts at the grocery store for my lunch break, because nice. Either my mom packed me something I didn't want, or she wasn't packing me lunch in the summer for my grocery store job. So I would buy. I think it was sort of a lack of parental supervision as well that was spurring me to buy something like that for a meal.
I remember in first year, I'm pretty sure that every time I would do groceries in first year, I would buy Pop-Tarts too.
what kind?
Nobody's telling me. I think it's strawberry.
Yeah, nice. I'll get the Oreo ones or the s'mores.
Oh, yeah.
Man, I'm a s'mores guy all the way.
Yeah. Oh. And I would eat two or three of those, like the silver packs in the boxes for a lunch. And all my coworkers at the grocery store would be like, what the hell is this kid doing?
Yeah. I think me and Tyler have some good stories about Pop-Tarts for our listeners. For our listeners on Patreon, you have to donate or whatever to get that story, but maybe we'll put it up there.
Yeah, for sure. I like to hear those stories, Adrian. I don't know if I remember them.
Yeah. In any case, transitioning here. You know, what's something money related that you thought was normal, but then you realized that it wasn't?
Yeah, I think my answer to this would actually be really recent, and it's sort of tied to what I was talking about with sort of mentally calculating my roommates' income and expenses, and just trying to do the same for people around me as well, which is that most people don't have the goal of saving. So for me, if I'm breaking even at the end of the month, that's really stressful and bad for me. And I think for most people, I don't know if it's stressful for them or not, but it's definitely way more normal than I thought it was.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I think there's a good side to that and a bad side to that, because again, a lot of, like, I think growing up, a lot of my self-worth was tied to money and my ability to save or not. And so I think some unnecessary stress came from that for me. But at the same time, financially, obviously, I'm in a better position with the sort of the goal of saving at the end of every month, as opposed to the goal of not being in debt or not being in a lot of debt or breaking even or whatever the goal of the general populace is, because it's definitely different than mine.
Yeah. Do you have, not to put you on the spot, but do you have like a general idea of how much percent you save per month of your income?
It fluctuates a lot. And part of me not tying my personal value so much to money, means that I'm not watching my finances as closely, especially because I know I have a lot of good financial habits that I don't have to worry about being in debt. And because, you know, I'm already looking at the prices at the grocery store. I'm already thinking about how many times I pay for public transit. And, you know, I never use Uber. I try to bike everywhere in the summer. Like, I have all these frugal habits built into me.
Yeah.
That I know that I don't have to look at my finances all the time. And so I would wager between 10 and 15%. And that's sort of my current goal in Toronto, and I'm not very happy with that because the living expenses are so high. I'm currently working for a charity. So my income is not the income ceiling is real. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's maybe 10 to 15%, but I would prefer something like 30%, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. That's still really good. Like you said, a lot of people probably just break even. And if you've got that saving mentality, like hardwired in your firmware, it's like, you don't even really need to bother thinking about the final net, you know, of every month, because you just constantly are saving money, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I feel bad when I save only 5% of my income. So I know that I'll almost never save 0%. It's always almost always a positive percentage of savings from my income.
Yeah. Nice. So yeah, like you've hit on it multiple times so far. You are definitely on the stingy side. Of things, stingy not having a negative connotation in this sense, but is there anything at all that you are splurgy on? Do you like a nice meal every once in a while? I know you're a multi-instrumentalist. Do you splurge on, you know, an instrument or two, or what is Big T spending Big M on? Well, I don't know.
Asking a big question.
I don't know what that... For the listeners, his name on our recording software is Big T. So cut this part out.
I tried to put some emojis in my name too, but it wouldn't let me. What is Big T spending Big M on?
That's the title of this episode, by the way.
that's a good question. I'll give you one thing that I wish I wasn't spending money on, and one thing that I'm perfectly happy spending money on. So the first thing is beer. I remember, Adrian, you were talking about this in an earlier episode, how you actually calculated, you know, each beer is what, $2 or $3, and then you have maybe one or two a night, or maybe a little more sometimes. That's like $6 to $9 a day, and then multiplying that out over a month just makes me really sad.
Yeah, it gets big really quickly.
It really does, especially like I think in Ontario the liquor prices are higher, and I'm happy with that because it's sort of a it's a deterrent for mild alcoholism, potentially. just like how the how cigarette prices are really high in Ontario. I think that's a good deterrent. I kind of agree with that. I don't agree with all the money going to the government from cigarettes and alcohol, but that's a whole different conversation. I'd rather not get into that now.
That's for the Young Libertarian podcast.
coming soon. So the thing that I wish I didn't spend money on was beer, and we have a lot of selection on Ontario too. So it's, you know, I get something new every time I go. I'm not buying Coors. I'm not buying 24 packs of Coors. It's more expensive for that reason too. So, and then one thing that I'm happy that I spend money on, and I'm happy I splurge on, is just athletic stuff in general. So you mentioned music. I actually don't spend any money on music because I have a couple of instruments that I'm happy with. I've had for a long time. And I actually worked at an instrument library for almost 2 years, where you can borrow any of the 900 plus instruments we have for free for a month. Wow. I often borrowed them for longer because I was working there.
Shout out to Joe's Mill in Kingston. Joe's Mill, go check them out. I don't know if they have a web page or whatever, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah, joesmill.org, JOESMILL. And thanks for that shout out, Adrian. They're an awesome charity. Love them. Could use all the support they can get. It's hard to get, again, on the risk of getting on another huge tangent here. The funding for like homeless charities and charities for kids starving in Africa is way easier to get than funding for music charities like Joe's Mill. So it's definitely important to support charities in the arts as well as mm-hmm. other charities that are meaningful. Yeah. So the second thing I spend money on that I'm happy to spend money on is athletic stuff related to my health. So I find it really hard to go to the gym or go for runs. So for me, I think it's really valuable for me to find activities that I like doing that are also good for my body. So I'll spend money on a pair of rock climbing shoes. I'll spend money on a usable, decent bike that I enjoy using. So all that stuff is definitely big M, but, T's pretty happy with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Nice. Produces big H.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yes. Big serotonin.
Yeah, big HT of, HT5, is that what it is?
HTT5. You wouldn't know, yeah.
Anyway,
on the topic of money spent towards beers, I have this app called Less, and I think it's made for alcoholics, so it's not really, I don't think any it's not really for us, but it's a good way to just track.
It might be for me.
It might also be for me.
it's a good way to just like. What you're supposed to do is you're supposed to like input the amount of drinks you have. So let's say, you know, you have those two beers or one beer after work every day. You can really easily just input that drink, and then it just like does a massive calculation of like how much money you've spent in the year, how much, you know, how many drinks you've had and all that stuff. And just to see the amount of money, like I use it just to track the amount of money that is spent towards, let's say, a beer. And it's insane. Like it really puts things in perspective, because I feel like even though we're aware of how much it is, we kind of think, oh, whatever, it's like, you know, just this amount, but then you actually see the real number and it kind of shakes you a little bit. On the topic of I guess, you know, purchases that you're not that proud of, what's the dumbest thing you've ever bought, Tyler?
Because it's stressful for me to spend money, so I it's hard for me to remember buying anything that's not well calculated, that I don't stress about for months before I actually buy it.
Yeah. What's the threshold of something that you stress about? Like for me, it's anything around 100 or more. Is there like a certain thing that makes you, stress about a certain purchase?
No, it's all relative, I think. I think it depends on the item too. Like if I'm buying food, I'll justify that as sort of like a health purchase, as like a something that gives me life and makes me happy, and right. that I need to do. So you know, if I'm out with friends, I don't like it, but I'll spend $50 on a meal and a couple beers or something.
Right.
But that same $50 applied to like a t-shirt, I would never do that. Or it'd have to be to support a band that I really like, it'd have to be something that I wear down to the threads. So, I might answer with alcohol as well. but in a different way, cause normally I'm as frugal as you can be with buying the types of drinks that I like to buy. So I'll buy craft beers, but only at LCBO. I won't really go out to bars very much, but when I do go out to bars, I think it's very easy to get out of control, and not necessarily in number of drinks, but in like total amount spent, because you buy one or two drinks and it's already starting to stress me out thinking about how much money it costs.
Yeah. And there's always that like really nice drink that's like $15 and you're like, oh, well, all these ingredients are so expensive on their own. I'll just get it here because I'll treat myself. And then you realize.
Yeah. Oh, actually, I have a better answer. When I was looking for jobs, when I got my current job, I thought one of my possible jobs, like career paths, was teaching English online or at a school. I have a teaching background already, but I don't have the specific certificate for teaching English. So I signed up for a course for that specific certificate. It's called TESOL, TESOL, and it cost me $700 to sign up, and it cost me $100 for the textbook. And at the time, I was like, yeah, this is great. You know, I'm paying for my future. I'm paying for my potential. And then I got really busy with applying to other types of jobs and interviewing for other types of jobs. And moving from Kingston to Toronto, and I just, it was an entirely self-directed course, and I did maybe the first of 8 parts, and I don't even know if I submitted that first part. So I basically crazy. Threw away
$700 for a self-directed course that I'm assuming you do online.
Yeah. Basically, it's $700 for someone to mark your answers and give you a piece of paper.
Wow. That's crazy. Would you ever consider finishing it?
No, so things just got really busy with my life around that period of time, and I was surprisingly happy to focus on all that other stuff going on in my life. As much as I think that was a stupid purchase, I don't think I really regret it, and I think it actually gave me a valuable insight into people who drop out of school, because I had never viewed myself as someone who would stop doing something that they already paid for just because I didn't like it at the time or I had more important stuff to do. Like I actually went to teacher's college, and maybe a quarter of the way through teacher's college, I knew that I wouldn't be a teacher.
What was that moment? Like, when did you realize that this wasn't for you?
I don't think it was a moment, because I was actually in a concurrent education program. So I did stints in classrooms. Stints makes it sound like sound negative. Like I'm biased. I did practicum placements in several classrooms throughout my undergrad before actually getting to the last year of teacher's college. And that was sort of a building experience to, maybe this isn't for me. And then in the first bit of teachers college, I realized I'm surrounded by all these other people who are so much more passionate about what we're doing than I am. It's a very competitive atmosphere, especially in the Ontario public system, that it just wasn't worth it for me to even pursue that career. But it was still worth it for me to continue with the education. I was essentially already paid for. I had already started it. So even though I didn't like it, and I knew that it wouldn't necessarily be super useful to me, at least in the immediate future, I still continued with it. But the self-directed online certificate was different for reasons, I think, that like it was online. It was less expensive. I had paid for it myself instead of my parents helping pay for it. So I felt less responsibility towards an outside party to actually finish it.
Yeah, that's a good point. So what did you do in undergrad? Like, what's your educational background, if you don't mind me asking? I know this is starting to sound like an interview, but like, what did you do in undergrad? And then how did you get to the job that you have now, I guess? Like, if you can quickly summarize it.
I did my undergrad in math and physics. And as I mentioned, I did the concurrent education program. So that means I got a little bit of teaching experience during my undergrad. And then I did a shortened version of Teachers College at the end. And when I was choosing degrees in high school to apply for, I chose to apply for engineering degrees and for this concurrent program. And honestly, I only applied to the concurrent education math and physics program because I heard that it was difficult to get into and I wanted to show off to my parents and friends that I could get into it. I had every intention of going the engineering route. And as you can probably assume, I actually got into both programs. And the night of the deadline for choosing between the two programs, on a whim, I sort of decided engineering kind of seems like you're spending a lot of time at a desk. Teaching, I had taught a little bit of tennis and music and tutored and babysat before. So I was like, I think I'd like teaching better than engineering. So I applied for it sort of as a joke. And then I actually ended up doing it.
Crazy that you have to decide your life at, you would have been what, 18, 17 when you made that decision?
Yeah, 17. Yeah, just 17, just barely 17.
Wow. And then you graduated, and then now you said you're at a, you work at a charity?
Yeah. So if I were to go back and choose when I was 17 again, I probably would have chosen something like computer science. I just think it's a lot more marketable, and the math part of my brain that made me want to go into math is actually really well suited for computer science as well. So in teachers college, you not only do placements in classrooms, but you also do what's called alternative placements or alternative practicum. And so for us, that could mean anything from teaching in an outdoor setting, at a conservation area or something, to teaching fitness classes, to I actually had a friend who he managed to convince them that shadowing his friend who was a DJ at stages would count as his alternative practicum.
Oh my god, that's amazing. Stages. Sorry, I'm sorry, you're gonna have to cut
that's
out.
Okay. Stages is a nightclub for those of you who don't know, a nightclub in Kingston for those of you who don't know. I don't know how he convinced them to do that, but there were a number of people in teachers college in my position who thought that maybe teaching would be okay for them and then realized that, I don't think this is the path I want to go to. So I think he was probably one of those people as well. And because I sort of had that mindset, I didn't look for something super teaching related. And instead, I decided to go back to... So I had actually used Joe's Mill, the instrument library, to borrow instruments when I was in high school So I'd borrow saxophones, cellos, guitars, banjos, mandolins, everything.
I remember you had a synth that was so amazing.
Yeah.
You had this like 1970s synth. I think it was 1970s. I don't know, but it was beat up, but it sounded amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I borrowed that a couple more times when I started working there. So the way that I actually ended up working there was that I did my alt prac there. I helped them chase down delinquent instrument loans. So again, I'm not really sure how that's related to teaching or how I got away with that. How I got away with doing that for a credit in teacher's college.
At least it's more incredible than shadowing a DJ at stages.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'd really like to see his argument for why that was a valuable alt prac. So I volunteered, did my alt prac there, chasing down the instruments. And then the person who was running the administrative side of things, left the library shortly after that. And, I just sort of, it was a sort of right place, right time sort of thing, where I was graduating teacher's college with a math and physics background. And I wasn't sure if I wanted to do something in math and physics. I wasn't sure if I wanted to do something in teaching. I wasn't sure if I wanted to go back to school or what I would even go back to school for. So I just sort of fell into running all the operations at the instrument library, which was, it was really cool. It was interesting. It was a very, very small charity. So I think if it was a larger operation, my job would be split into 5 or 6 different job titles. So I got a lot of experience doing all sorts of different stuff, but I think that position, or that type of position, is really prone to burnout. A year and a half, 2 years later, I decided, hey, I've had enough with this. I've lived in Kingston my whole life. I want to live somewhere new. And Toronto is relatively close to Kingston and is pretty new for me. So I applied to a bunch of jobs in Toronto. And because I had the charity background of essentially running this charity and doing all sorts of different little jobs within it, I thought it would be an easy transition to apply for charity jobs in Toronto. And so now I work for a homeless charity in Toronto. And we have rent geared to income apartments for 110 people live in our building right now. We have a free dental clinic. We have a trustee program, so we help people manage their money. We help people find housing. We have a drop-in center where people can take showers, do their laundry, and get food all for free. We give out clothes for free. So I'm still trying to figure out sort of my elevator pitch for it because it's so many services in one building. But I'm going
where
from
does the,
a...
Where does the funding come from? This sounds really cool.
Yeah, so it's really interesting that we're a mission of the Presbyterian Church in Canada. So that's been we could have a whole other discussion about how that's been interesting to me as a non-religious person and to the other non-religious people working there. But I don't want to drag this on too long. So, yeah, we get a lot of funding from very, very dedicated, traditional, older people. And then we also get a little bit of city and government funding, but more than, I don't know the exact percentages, but a reasonable amount of our funding, a reasonable majority of our funding comes from in some way or another from the church community.
Whoa, that's really cool.
Yeah, it makes things a lot easier and more predictable, especially coming from an arts charity and going to a homeless people charity. As I was saying earlier, the funding is a lot more readily available, both from individuals and organizations for, you know, say, starving homeless people than just people borrowing a guitar.
Yeah.
Yeah, so do you want to close it up with our recurring question? If you had $1 million right now, how would you spend it?
I'd flex.
You'd flex?
I'd flex.
Right after talking please, about giving money.
Please elaborate.
No, I'm saying that as a joke because we were talking about that. I think probably before we started recording the podcast.
Yeah.
No, I would do the opposite of flex. I would I'd buy a bunch of GICs, guaranteed investment certificates, essentially government bonds.
Yeah, I've seen those. Yeah, you're guaranteed like some growth rate over 5 years or 10 years or whatever.
Yeah, you can buy them for as little as a month at a time, actually, but the growth rate is essentially negligible over that period of time. So unless you're investing $1 million in a bond, it's not really useful.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I tend to buy for the 1 to 2 year mark. And again, I'm fortunate enough to have the background where I have the skills to save money to put towards that, and I have I had the financial support of my parents through university and through the early portion of my life, so I'm not coming out of university with debt, for example. So yeah, I'm lucky enough to be able to save my money through GICs, and that is probably where I'd put $100,000 to $200,000 of the million. Then the remainder I would spend on a house. I would probably spend maybe $500,000 or $600,000 on a house, maybe a little less. Preferably a duplex in a smaller city like St. Catharines or Halifax. And I would buy a duplex so that I could live in one unit while I rent out the other unit and essentially live for free.
Oh, nice.
And then the remaining $100,000 to $200,000 I would spend I would keep that as in a high interest savings account for expenses, so that I could be financially independent and not have to rely on a job for income. So I've heard from a lot of people in the FIRE community, financial independence retire early, FIRE, I've heard this story several times that people really hated their job and then they became financially independent, and that same job, because they weren't dependent on it to live, they didn't hate it anymore. They actually loved it. They loved coming in. They felt more powerful and influential. And they felt like they had a lot more control over their own life. So that's what I would do with the last $100,000 or $200,000, is essentially buy myself financial independence. I would take a little bit of time off from work, I think, first, and find something that's a little more meaningful to me. As I was saying, I sort of fell into the charity space, and it made sense for me to apply for charity jobs, especially when I was moving cities. So I'm not sure if I'll remain in this role or organization or even this sector for very long, but I would take some of that money and just spend it on living expenses so that I could spend some time figuring out what I need to do.
Nice. I was just thinking, because you've kind of touched on GICs and FIRE, and you know, you've sort of alluded to this investment knowledge that you've got from your parents. Is there anything that, if let's say I was somebody listening to this podcast and I was a complete mess financially, I'm in debt, don't know where to start, is there any quick and dirty one or two steps that you would tell that person to sort of start to get their finances in order?
Yeah. I think there are different strategies that work for different people. So for some people, just starting off by making a budget would be really valuable for them. And then sort of as we, I guess, sort of go up the chain of how much trouble you're in, I think I would start with making a budget. Then I would move on to consolidating any debt that I have. And by that, I mean, a lot of credit cards, for example, have promotional interest rates for 6 months or 12 months when you first sign up for them. So for example, if you have a really high credit card debt, and you're being charged 20% interest on it. And you do what's called a balance transfer to a new credit card. That new credit card will often offer as low as 1% to 5% interest. So a really drastic reduction in interest for that 6 to 12 month period, which can really sort of like stem the bleeding a little bit. If you're accruing 20% interest every month on this credit card debt you've had for years, I would recommend consolidating that interest via a balance transfer to a new credit card. Again, I'm lucky enough to never have done that. So I'm not sure what the specifics of those are, but I've seen ads for debt consolidation. Essentially just find the lowest percent interest that will take on your existing debt. So you can sort of flatten your own curve.
Nice. Yeah. I think that's something that even through doing this podcast, we had a guest, I think in episode 6, that talked about how these interest rates and basically any agreement that you engage in with credit cards is kind of negotiable, and you kind of have a lot of wiggle room to try and put yourself in a better situation. And I never knew that until doing this podcast.
Yeah. I didn't know that aside for the balance transfer, the thing that I just talked about either. No, that's good. Another little thing that I think you could do is take advantage of like credit card rewards and other promotions at banks, but that's a little further up the chain. Is that if you're not swimming in debt already, you have a little bit of money to swing around. I would suggest spending that extra money on bank promos and GICs. I wouldn't suggest first spending in the stock market. Save up your emergency fund of, I think people suggest 3 to 6 months, but I'm more comfortable with 6 to 12 months of living expenses in preferably something you can access immediately as needed. So a high interest savings account, and then all the overflow should go in GICs.
Yeah, that's really good advice.
Thanks.
All right, Tyler, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us. This is awesome. Thanks for listening, everyone out there. Until next time, we'll see you then, or we'll see you on another time.
Awesome.